This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Parity Mukherjee, writes about what she describes as America's new immigrants. She's written 5 novels, 2 nonfiction books, and 2 collections of short stories, one of which won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Mukherjee was born in Calcutta, India, in 1940, to a wealthy Brahmin family. After studying literature in India, she attended the Iowa Writers' Workshop in the early 60s, which is where she met her husband. She became an American citizen in 1988. This is not the life her parents had intended for her. In fact, they planned an arranged marriage, which she rejected. Arranged marriage is one of the traditions at the heart of Mukherjee's new novel, Desirable Daughters. It's about 3 sisters who come from a family similar to Mukherjee's. Each sister has a different approach to maintaining or rejecting the traditions of the culture. Like Mukherjee's new novel, the new film Monsoon Wedding looks at arranged marriage versus romantic love. I asked Mukherjee how common arranged marriages are in India now.
It's still very common. In fact, I have my only nephew, who's 28 years old, living with me for 2 years while he goes to MBA school in San Francisco, who's going through the arranged marriage only via the internet rather than actual marriage brokers coming to your house, knocking on the door.
He's doing it through the internet? How?
The proposals come via the internet, and so his parents forward them to us in San Francisco, and he's also on email to young Indo-American women or young Indian women on H-1B visas, whom he hasn't seen, but it's email getting to know each other.
Well, that's a kind of interesting mix of tradition and modern technology.
Right, right. It's a 21st century version of hanging on to traditions. But in a way, I feel that it makes it even harder to know who you're hooking up with.
Does he want an arranged marriage?
Yes, this young man very much so.
Why?
I think he needs that certainty, and he intends to go back to India after he finishes his degree and gets maybe a year or two of work experience. He wants to have the option of going back.
So he wants the certainty of what? Of knowing that he'll have a partner? Because he doesn't have the certainty of knowing he'll love the person.
He, I think, assumes that love only blossoms after marriage, and perhaps this is like an MBA student. Wants to avoid the chaos of emotional ups and downs that I and my characters so wholeheartedly embrace.
Yes, well, you were supposed to have an arranged marriage. Your parents had selected a man for you when you were, I guess, still a teenager and living in India. Had you asked them to do that, or did they just take that on themselves?
Oh, no, they took it upon themselves. There was never any question of expressing my wishes, ideas, politics. My father decided what we wore, what opinions we had on trivial and important things, and we simply mouthed them.
Well, how did you say no to your parents?
Impulse. I think very much like Tara, the narrator in Desirable Daughters, I found that the moment that I hit Iowa as a graduate student, that it was the beginning of the making of a consciousness, that I'd come out of such a protected world. I feel now there was no bubble wrap in those days, but I feel now that in a way I was bubble wrapped in innocence and kept away from any kind of possibility of breaking rules or thinking bad thoughts. So that the moment I came here to the United States, it became an occasion for me to try out all the subterraneous personalities that I had learned to conceal from adults.
When you told your parents that you didn't want the arranged marriage, what was their reaction?
Actually, mine was even more dramatic or melodramatic than that. I sent a cable to my father saying, by the time you get this, I'll already be married. So there was very little that my wonderfully patriarchal father could do about the situation. I'm fell in love over a two-week courtship with a fellow student in the writer's workshop at the University of Iowa, writer named Clark Blaise. That was 38 years ago, by the way. And we got married during a lunch break in the lawyer's office above the coffee shop. That lawyer's office is still there in Iowa City.
And you're still married.
And I'm still married.
So were your parents very angry with you? Did they accept that this was your choice and that you'd be happy?
They were devastated that I'd had the guts or the audacity to take a decision on my own. They'd never expected me to break any kind of parental rule. Or I'd been very careful not to expose my very emotional nature to them.
Your novel, Desirable Daughters, is about three sisters. One of them stays in India. Two of them come to America. Do you have any siblings who stayed behind in India?
I have one. My youngest sister stays in India. And it's her one and only son who is now living with us in San Francisco and going to school here.
Right. Is her life and your life very different?
It's very much like the Parvati character. Her life is very much like that of the Parvati character in the novel, the one who stays in Bombay and is the wife of a senior corporate man. She has been the bridge, or made herself a bridge, between modern India traditions and at the same time rebelled against my father's choice of husband for her.
So she didn't have an arranged marriage?
No, none of us did. My poor father tried so hard, and each of us three sisters went our own ways.
Gee, that makes it seem all the more remarkable that your nephew would choose an arranged marriage, considering his parents didn't have one.
I wonder if that's a kind of a reaction. His traditionalism is a kind of reaction against the impulsiveness of his mother and aunts. And I see that in some ways with the first-generation Indo-Americans, who quite often are far more Indian and profess to be far more Indian in their love of culture or in their attitudes than the Indian counterparts living in big cities in India or the immigrant generation who knew that they must let go something.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Parvati Mukherjee, and her new novel, Desirable Daughters, has to do with arranged marriage. It's about three sisters who are from India, two who live in the United States. Although you grew up in a Hindu family, you went to a convent school. Why would Hindu parents send you to an Irish Catholic convent school?
Oh, that's still quite common. That was the pattern, certainly when I was going to school, that if you were from what we called one of the best families in town, then you went to, if you were a girl, you went to Loretta House on Middleton Row, fancy formerly British area, to this convent run by Irish nuns from Galway. And if you were a male child, you were sent to St. Xavier's College, also in the same area, which was run by Jesuit priests from Belgium. And so we kept our school lives where we celebrated St. Patrick's Day with shamrock flown out of Galway, and our Hindu home life, very, very separate.
So what exactly were the advantages of going to the convent school? Was it that you were getting a Western education? Or?
It was very hard to get into that school, and it was really about how respected your family was in town. And so going there meant you were assured excellent bridegroom prospects.
I see.
And, and good manners, and very well guarded. We were chaperoned all the time.
I see. I think, is it in your book you say that it also assured that you were going to be a virgin?
Yes, absolutely. But it's just that all that was fraudulent, I realize now, as does my narrator, Tara, that we kept the appearance of absolute purity and absolute innocence to the point of naivety, but there were rebellions going on, only you learned how to hide it.
Mm-hmm.
We also had, by the way, two most important classes in that school were elocution and table manners.
How did you react to that?
Loved it.
Really?
Yes.
What did you love about learning table manners?
We were told by the nuns that our girls can go to any big city in the world, Paris, London, New York, and they'll know how to conduct themselves. And we thought that was a pretty cool thing to be. And the elocution was we read plays out loud. We had play reading groups. Oscar Wilde, Noel Coward, all these. I could do all the parts as if I were an English male of a certain generation.
And when you came to the United States, what year was that?
1961, fall of 1961.
So you came to the United States and got married before the women's movement of the late 60s.
The movement, meaning Doris Lessing's The Golden Notebook and Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, were just beginning to be read, 63 and so on. So I was very much here in the United States as people were getting taking aggressive or self-assertive acts to equalize rights.
Now, as an inveterate reader and as a novelist, what are the books that really reached you that spoke about the woman's condition in the 60s and that inspired you to map out your life?
It was a mixture. I loved The Golden Notebook, but I also loved Emma Bovary and her misguided attempts to liberate herself from what I saw as a very provincial kind of repression of her free spirit. So it was everything combined, but the most important narrative to me was my own life, the experiences I was having, because I was, while other women, my women friends, were throwing pots or trying out painting.
You mean you're making pottery when you say throwing pots?
Yes, sorry. making pottery, going to art classes, you know, working with their hands, nice clay medium. And they were also going to consciousness-raising groups and examining themselves with mirrors and so on. I was, you know, too shy to look at my body. I still can't do those tests for finding, tumors in one's breasts. I'm that not at ease with my body, I guess. And certainly the whole idea of consciousness raising, where you write down what the husband's duties are about taking out garbage or doing the gardening and who does the dishes when, all those kinds of things struck me as so irrelevant to my life, where Clark and I had small children. We were both going to school. I was getting my PhD. I was teaching full time and bringing up, going to the laundromat to clean diapers before going off to teach. That I had no time for that kind of thinking through feminist agenda.
My guest is Bharati Mukherjee. Her new novel is called Desirable Daughters. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Bharati Mukherjee. Her new novel, Desirable Daughters, is about three Indian sisters and how each deals with maintaining or rejecting the traditions they were brought up with. Mukherjee was born in Calcutta and has lived in North America since the early 60s. When did you know you wanted to write?
From age 3. I was a precocious child, and I lived in stories, inside stories.
Would your family have considered it acceptable for you to be a writer?
Because I was a woman, and as long as I wasn't writing anything that might be considered rude, such as sex, violence, it would be okay, yes. They thought of it as an accomplishment, womanly accomplishment. gift of the pen is what the phrase they used.
And have you written about sex or things that are rude?
I'm afraid so. And for my characters, including Tara, sexuality becomes a favored way of expressing revolution, trying out a life outside the box.
Is it hard for you to write that way, since you said you're too uncomfortable to even do self-exams?
No. I think for me, my fiction is a way of getting in touch with my inner bad girl. And so, you know, I want in my fantasies to be a cross between Rita Hayworth and Diana Ross.
And not the Hindu convent girl.
No. And once I'm in that mode, you know, inside the character,
anything goes.
I can do bad things.
No, I've read that there was a period when you, of a few years when you lived in Canada, and that this
14 years, yeah.
And that overlap with the period when several thousand refugees left Idi Amin's Uganda, and about 5,000 of those refugees, people who were formerly, I think, from India.
They were second and third generation Ugandans of
Asian descent.
Yes. And they had British passports, which mm-hmm. Britain did not honor. And so the Canadian Prime Minister of that time, Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau, very kindly offered them residence, green cards. And that caused a sudden, really unanticipated, at least by me, backlash against brown immigrants. And the government didn't react to control that backlash in the way that it should have.
Why do you think there was a backlash, and how did it directly affect you?
Oh, dear. It meant that anyone with a brown face in cities like Toronto, Vancouver, was fair game for physical harassment as well as verbal harassment on the street. And so, you know, there were incidents every day. And I was a victim of many such incidents of not being served in stores or being roughed up by teenagers in blue jeans overalls in subway, on subway platforms, or being, you know, thrown out of lobbies of fancy hotels if my white husband wasn't near me, or being given secondary examination in airports, or racial profiling. And there was no, in the Canada of those early 70s to late 70s, in fact, through the 70s, there was no constitution in Canada. The constitution hadn't yet been repatriated. And so there was no Bill of Rights. There was no legal agency of redress against race-based hate crime.
What must have been particularly odd for you during that experience in Canada, when you felt that there was a lot of backlash, you had come from a very elite family in Calcutta. Your family was wealthy. You were among...
We were brought up to think well of ourselves and that our ideas mattered.
Right. So what? It must have been a very kind of educational experience to suddenly be perceived not as the elite, but as the inferior, and to have people, you know, even attacking you because of that. I'm sure you could use a lot of words other than educational to describe that experience. But I'm sure someone like you really walked away from
it. It was
that
devastating.
Learning a lot, yeah.
Yes, it was totally, totally devastating to me to be seen as, you know, an unwanted Canadian, mm-hmm. as a smelly immigrant, a potential burglar and con artist and so on. And it made me reassess my status, my own attitudes towards minorities in India while I had been growing up, how unconsciously racist or ethnicist I may have been myself in relation to Indian minorities. And having been an elite in Calcutta, brought up to believe that my ideas matter meant that I had the gutsiness to take on government officials in Canada and say, you can't do this, this is not right, and I know what's right, and I'm jolly well going to tell you how to set it right. It didn't work, but, you know, I was caught in two simultaneous roles. One as someone who's very confident of herself and knows right from wrong and feels very strongly about civil rights, human rights, and the other who feels impotent that there'll be no change in the way that the country thinks. I'm so glad, though, I've been proved wrong, and that Canada is a very habitable place.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Bharati Mukherjee is the author of the new novel, Desirable Daughters. She's a professor of English at the University of California at Berkeley. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.